from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the economic boom of the 90s, the money rolled into state treasuries. Legislators spent freely on big-ticket items, health care and education. Then the gold rush ended. Revenues shrank and the bills piled up. Now states are in crisis and desperate for a way out of their budgetary black hole. In this hour, On Point, what to do when states go broke. We begin with a first-hand account of what it's like to be in the fiscal hot seat. Democratic Governor Mark Warner of Virginia addresses his General Assembly tomorrow about the nearly $6 billion deficit now facing Virginia. I asked him to describe the impact of the budget crunch in his state.
Well, when I was first elected a year ago, I discovered that the budget shortfall that had been publicly announced at about $700 million was actually $3.8 billion. And that's on about a $25 billion a year base. So it was a substantial shortfall. We worked through that during the General Assembly session, and I actually thought we were a little bit out of the woods, but as we all know now, the state fiscal revenues have had their worst year in 50 years, and we are now confronting an additional $2.1 billion shortfall, of which about close to half of that I closed with executive-level cuts in mid-October, and then tomorrow I will be submitting the balance of my cuts. It really has been the largest budget shortfall combined in Virginia history, and we've eliminated close to 6,000 positions in state government and made some really tough choices.
That's a large number, and a lot of choices obviously have been made, nearly a $6 billion shortfall. Give us a material sense of what this has meant for the state of Virginia, for Virginians. How have these cuts shown up? How will they show up in the months and years ahead?
Well, they've shown up in cuts at higher education, which luckily we've been able to replace with tuition increases for the most part. Virginia in-state tuitions were extraordinarily low, below market, and they've been brought up closer to market. Mm-hmm. We've cut 140 different programs. We have particularly had some problems at our Department of Motor Vehicles, where the cuts there have required certain offices to close. And
never popular.
Yeah, not very popular for folks waiting in line. But on the other hand, when the choices are waiting in line a little bit longer at the DMV versus cutting health care for indigent people, in my mind, that's a fairly easy choice. We have managed, though, to maintain through this process preserving public education, minimal cuts to public safety, and ensuring that our core transportation construction budget has not been hit either. So it really has caused us to go back to basics in terms of state government. And the fact that we reforecast our revenues this past summer and made the cuts in October really means that we're ahead of most states, in particular those states who've just elected new governors, because while I was with a number of the new governors in Austin, they all came to me and said, Governor, we heard how you've been dealing with the problems. We're finding that our predecessors are actually leaving us with a bigger budget deficit than what was publicly announced. And I said, I know where you're coming from. It has also, though, given us a chance to reexamine everything we do in state government. And we're putting forward the most extensive governmental reform package in the last generation in Virginia.
So is this the kind of period of crisis that's going to lead to a reshaped, reformed government, a new relationship between state government and state constituents?
To a degree, yes. We're finding, though, that kind of the silver lining in this otherwise challenging time, let's take mental health for a moment. We in Virginia, as in most states, have recognized that mental health services are better delivered at the community level than at the institution level. But for years, people have talked about it, but there's never been the will from the mental health advocates and community-based groups and institutions to come together and find a plan. The very real threat of cuts, and actually we even made some cuts in community-based mental health care, which I was very reluctant to do, but it's forced the parties to come together, and now we've got the most major mental health reform in the last 30 years being forward, where we're going to be diverting funds from institutions into community-based care. In technology, I was in the technology field before I was in politics. This is my first elective office. We are consolidating 91 separate state agencies, their technology departments, into a single agency, so we don't have the kind of duplication. We have, I think at this point, every email system known to man somewhere inside state government. We buy Dell computers for 28 different sources from 28 different prices. Crazy practices, but in good times, the status quo is such you can't make the reform. So we're making major technology consolidation.
Hard times mean reforms, but I guess on balance, the question is, does the state come out ahead, or is this budget crunch leaving a net negative in the life of the state, in the life of Virginians?
Well, I believe that there are a number of areas that out of this budget cutting period, even with efficiencies and belt tightening, will be underfunded. But at least in Virginia, what we did during the late 90s, what my predecessor and others did, was they dramatically cut taxes and increased spending and assumed that the go-go days of the 90s were going to last forever. Well, that was a faulty business premise, and that house of cards totally collapsed. What I'm trying to restore is some level of trust with the people of Virginia that we can be good stewards of their tax dollar. And after we go through this process, after we've streamlined and downsized and brought about every efficiency we possibly can, it still begs the question then of, all right, what do you Virginians want from state government and how much are you willing to pay for it?
Yes, and there's the revenue side of all this. We read that you're facing the steepest drop in state revenue growth in 40 years. Is there a prospect for that to return, or do you just have to get used to the idea of lower revenue growth? Do you have to look at new taxes?
We're not proposing new taxes at this point. But the idea that even with economic recovery, we'll not get back in terms of the state revenues back to the years 1999 and 2000 for the next decade. So it does beg the question of a major tax restructuring, ask that very real question to the people of Virginia. All right, what do you want from state government and what are you willing to pay for?
Do you think that what Virginia has been offering is so overblown that you can go through 10 years of much reduced services and it's all right because you're reaching a better balance?
No.
Or is this just not an acceptable picture at the moment?
Well, not in my mind. It is not an acceptable picture. I mean, Virginia has prided itself on a wonderful public college and university system, often regarded as one of the best in the nation, with UVA and William & Mary and Virginia Tech. The question I ask is, do we want to still continue to have world-class universities that produce Nobel Prize laureates, or are we willing to have an also-ran system? Do we want 95% of our kids to pass at the K-12 level on what we call our standards of learning, our assessment tests, or are we willing to have 70%? What kind of transportation system? 21st century, or are we willing to sit in traffic for hours? These kind of questions, though, I think come out of, one, recognition that the idea that you can cut taxes and increase spending, that's a fiscal house of cards that doesn't work. And hopefully out of our reform package will come the sense that Virginians will have was that with the dollars that they're giving us, we're being good stewards. And then if we go back and say, well, we want to invest a little bit more in education, that the people would be willing to say, well, if those dollars would then be well spent on those purposes,
then let's do it.
Right. But you can't get to that debate until you restore the trust.
But ultimately, Governor Warner, you're confident that Virginians are going to say, yes, there's a bottom line of what we want to offer to ourselves as a state below which we're not willing to go. And one way or another, when trust is restored, we're willing to step up and pay for that.
That is my hope and my belief. But the first two steps have been disabusing the people of Virginia of the notion that you can have it all for nothing, that you can, again, cut taxes and increase spending. That's just a faulty premise. Secondly, then, that we will go through this and make the hard choices, which we have, eliminating 6,000 positions and cutting almost $6 billion. The third step is then bring about a reform package that is the biggest in the last generation. And at the end of that process, then I hope to embark on basically a conversation with the people of Virginia for the balance of the year, which says, okay, we've tightened our belt. What do you want? What do you want, and what are you willing to pay for?
Governor Warner, thanks for joining us.
Tom, thank you.
Mark Warner is Democratic governor of Virginia. He spoke with us earlier today from Richmond, Virginia. Two-thirds of states from California to Connecticut are swimming in red ink, facing what some have called the worst state budget crisis in 30 years. Many of the same legislators who authorized spending increases in the 90s boom now find themselves in a budget-cutting dilemma worthy of King Solomon. Do you cut back on education or health care, on prisons or nursing homes? Are you feeling the pinch of cutbacks in your state, your town? What's falling apart as your state hits the wall? And should Washington intervene when state treasuries run dry or leave states to dig themselves out? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Albany, New York, is Nicholas Jenny, a senior policy analyst with the Fiscal Studies Program at the Rockefeller Institute of Government. Good evening and welcome, Nicholas Jenny.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from New York is tonight's On Point News analyst, Amity Schley, senior columnist at the Financial Times. Hello, Amity.
Hello.
Good to have you on, Amity. Nicholas Jenny, take us into this. You heard Governor Warner saying that it was a deadly formula in the 90s. States cut taxes and increased spending. Do you share that? Is that what brought us here?
Well, it certainly, I mean, it was a universal experience. It wasn't just Virginia. It was just about every state was mm-hmm. doing that. And revenues were growing so fast that they had the money to do both of those things. And politically, if you can do both of those things, it's probably pretty hard to resist.
Very popular.
Yeah. And so we saw some, you know, pretty substantial tax cuts in a lot of states. And we also saw a lot of spending increases, mostly in, you know, favorite programs, things that a lot of people want, primary, secondary education, better transportation. There was a lot of money put into corrections, especially early in the 90s. Most of these things were quite popular. And so it's, you know, it's easy to say, well, you know, they went too far because now we're in a big hole. But it's also hard to see what you really could have done differently. I mean, states were also saving some money. They were building up reserves or rainy day funds, which is what they were told they should do. So that the problem with that is that when the recession hit, the revenue went away so fast that they found themselves very, very quickly in a pretty deep hole.
And most of those rainy day funds are already depleted. How deep is the hole, Nicholas Jenny? How bad is the crunch that states are facing across the country today?
It's remarkably it's a remarkably big hole, considering that this wasn't a particularly bad recession. We've heard from the National Governors Association, they're tracing, you know, saying this is the worst since the Second World War. Mm-hmm. I can't attest to that with numbers, but we can certainly look back at the last couple of recessions in the early 90s and the early 80s. And if you look at that, just the amount of drop that we've seen in state collections of taxes is really just much like an order of magnitude larger than we saw in those recessions, and so it was I think a little hard to anticipate how bad this was going to be. I mean, everybody knew eventually you're going to have a recession, but that it would be this bad on the revenue side, I think, surprised just about everybody.
Give us a sense of how those revenues have fallen off in terms of personal taxes, sales taxes, corporate income taxes. What's the drop off been like?
The big drop off was in the personal income tax, where we saw drops in the last. Looking at the last fiscal year, which is usually a July to June fiscal year for most states, the drop off in personal income tax collections was about 12%, which is pretty steep. But there were states where it was even worse than that. California saw more than 25% of its personal income tax disappear in the course of a year. It's really hard to be ready for that.
These are much steeper drops than the GDP has dropped. Why are revenues falling faster than in previous recessions, faster than the economy itself?
A lot of the reason was sort of the same thing that was helping the states in the late 90s is hurting them now. We saw a big run-up in the stock market. A lot more people became investors and were getting capital gains income and stock options and bonuses and so forth. And most of this was being taxed in the states with progressive personal income taxes that are being taxed at the top rate. So we saw a great big run-up in that, and that seems to be what is really going away now. I've seen people estimating that capital gains tax collections might be down 50%.
That's a heck of a drop. Amity Schles, so what's the solution here? Do we bail them out or let them swim out on their own strength, what they have left of it?
Oh, I would not bail them out. I think the founding fathers would be very disturbed to see the states and the federal government getting that much more closer together. In fact, you can argue that some of the problems of the states are caused by the too much intervention from the feds.
That is unfunded mandates.
Medicaid is a federal mandate.
Mm-hmm.
And Medicaid is one of the terrible drivers that's causing so much trouble on the state budgets. If state budgets don't watch out by 2020, Medicaid will be all all their outlays. So we don't want the feds in here, no.
That's a prospect and a half. We're going to talk about that tonight. We're looking at state governments in crisis. They're broke and they don't know how to fix it. Is your state in a state of fiscal crisis? Are you feeling the pinch of cutbacks in your town? And why are states facing this calamity now? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about state governments in crisis. They're broke and they don't know how to fix it. Should states drowning in red ink be bailed out by the federal government? And why do state governments swing so often between feast and famine? Do we have too many state services or too little state revenue? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Nicholas Jenny. He's Senior Policy Analyst with the Fiscal Studies Program at the Rockefeller Institute of Government. We're also joined by On Point News Analyst tonight, Amity Schles. Nicholas Jenny, what's your prescription for states getting out of this very deep hole you've described?
Well, I mean, you're stuck with a fairly simple and insidious equation, which is that states have this large gap. Unless they have reserves or something that they can throw in, which they mostly threw in last year, you have to either look at the tax side or the spending side, because you have to balance the budget at the state level, unlike the federal government. And so you have to look at either trying to find some place where you can cut spending enough to get into balance, or you have to raise taxes, or both, which probably a lot of states are going to be doing.
Can states step up and do that? Can they raise taxes enough to fill these holes? Can they really and truly make the cuts that are large enough to fill these holes? I'm looking here at a list of things that people are doing already. In Virginia, we talked with the governor there. They're deciding not to take misdemeanor domestic violence cases on in the Virginia Beach Prosecutor's Office, for example. Oregon, they're going to stop prosecuting minor nonviolent crimes like shoplifting and prostitution until the fiscal year ends on June 30th. Everyone read today, Kentucky is letting prisoners out of jail. California, the quote from the Assembly Speaker there, Herb Wesson, is, if we fired every state employee, every highway patrol officer, every UC professor, every parks patrol officer, we would still be more than $6 billion short. What if they simply can't make it up? Or is there no such thing? Do they just have to start shutting off the lights?
Well, you have to, I mean, in a sense, you have to do something. I mean, if you look back at the last recession 10 years ago, it wasn't as big a hole. But what states really did then is they raised taxes in a pretty big way. And that cost some people their jobs, which has kind of shifted the political environment now that you have a lot of people in office at this point who are adamantly opposed to the idea of increasing taxes.
You mean it cost politicians their jobs because the higher taxes were unpopular?
That's right. I mean, Jim Florio in New Jersey is sort of the archetypical example of that. The backlash there was, you know, violent almost. And politicians don't usually want to get in the way of something like that. So it's not so much that they're worrying about what happened to somebody 10 years ago. It's just you have a different breed of people winning elections nowadays, and most of them do not want to raise taxes and believe that it's a bad idea to do so.
Amity, look at the economics of this. Here we have the federal government eager to cut taxes to stimulate the economy, and states possibly facing feeling required to raise taxes to cover all this red ink. It looks as though the two elements of government are working at cross purposes there.
Well, it's not just economic opportunism or cowardice on the part of state politicians that makes them reluctant to cut taxes. It's also their recognition that states have to be relatively competitive. And a state with lower taxes grows faster than a state with higher taxes. There's a nice Atlanta Fed study that shows that. And a lot of the growth, you want to look at it in a positive sense, too, in the 90s. A lot of the growth we saw was due to the relative competitiveness of certain states, those with lower taxes, and the relative competitiveness of the United States, which also is a relative tax haven. Low taxes aren't all bad. They help growth, and sometimes that helps you get out of the deficit. But we do all agree here that spending has to be cut. There's nobody who doesn't agree with that.
Amity, given that these are imminent budget crunches, I mean, people are facing it right now, the need to cut another billion, $2 billion, $6 million. California's got, what, a $30 billion problem. Economic growth is not going to kick in quickly enough to pull them out of that hole, is it?
Well, I think you have to just look at things in the longer run when you can. And the states that, last time, and we had this experience before, maybe it wasn't so bad that we had it, William Weld, John Egler, George Pataki, Frank Keating, Christy Whitman, Zell Miller, refused to raise taxes after the last crunch.
Tax cutters, in fact.
Tax cutters, or used fiscal crisis as an opportunity for reform, maybe like Governor Warner, they came out winners, they were reelected, and many of their states also grew.
I want to welcome into our conversation Arturo Perez. He joins us from Denver, Colorado. He's an analyst with the Fiscal Affairs Program at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Good evening and welcome, Arturo Perez.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Arturo Perez, we're hearing a prescription here just now from our Amity Schlaes that says this is no time to be raising taxes and certainly not to be turning to the federal government. Keeping taxes low is the answer. It will generate economic growth and be a real long-term solution for states. Do you see that as the way out of this crisis?
The problem states face, and they'll face this when they convene their legislative sessions starting next month in most cases, is that the simple equation is this. Revenues must meet expenditures, or expenditures must be equal the revenues available for states. And the problem this year is that states have growing budget shortfalls, and they can either raise taxes, cut spending, or do any number of other things that they've already tried this past year. So it's some very difficult decisions that lawmakers will be faced with. What they decide to do will obviously be, will depend on what their views are or what their priorities are, whether priorities are to try to maintain K-12 education spending at levels that are equal to what they are now, or you know, do the other things that are going to be necessary to meet the priorities that they've been elected on or pushing.
Arturo Perez, what kind of consequences are you seeing out there as states grapple with these budget shortfalls?
Much of what we saw this past year, the problem, you have to understand, started not this year, but rather started last year, mm-hmm. in last fiscal year, and we saw states across the country implement across-the-board budget cuts, targeted spending reductions in particular programs, whether it's higher education, K-12, Medicaid, corrections, other areas. And we also saw states, during the 1990s, there was an increase in revenues. At the same time, states were rather prudent in building up their reserves to their highest levels since 1980. And that came in a very useful way this past year when states were able to go to the rainy day fund when revenues started dropping.
But they weren't prudent enough to prepare for this hole.
Well, no. Rainy day funds, as rule of thumb, are somewhere normally in the neighborhood of about 5% of your general fund budget, and that's what Wall Street analysts like to see states maintain. We were actually above that on an aggregate basis across the country, but this shortfall or this problem that states have run into was well above that percentage. And so even if states drained out their entire rainy day fund, as some states did, that still wasn't enough. It's not necessarily what states can use to solve their problems entirely, but rather it helps soften or make it easier to resolve some of the budget problems, and we saw states use the rainy day funds in that way.
Arturo Perez, are all the states going to make it, or are some just going to, you know, run splat into the wall and simply not have their budget add up when they're required to?
When it's all said and done, states will get through this problem as they did during the last recession and all prior recessions. They will make some very hard decisions, and they will have to resolve these problems. That's a simple, truth to this, is that states will have to find some solutions to their budget problems.
And you're not looking to the federal government to bail them out?
Bailout is a strong word. We'd like the federal government to meet its existing obligations under current mandates and not to...
Those sound like soft words, if bailout is a strong word. What do you mean exactly there?
What we're talking about in terms of the federal role in this is that the feds agree to meet their obligations. And let's take an example like the... a program called IDEA, which involves special education. The feds agreed to pay 40% of that new program that's being instituted across the country. But their support so far has fallen well below that level of or promised level of support. And that's one example of what we're talking about here.
So you want the feds to stand up and pay for what they've promised to pay for. Still, the hole looks awfully big. Nicholas, Arturo, Amity, please stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Bill's calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good, thanks.
What we have here in Massachusetts is a huge budget deficit, and over $2 billion.
Yeah.
And they just raised taxes. What was supposed to happen was the rollback. They did the rollback, but they froze it, the legislature did. And what's happened is, even with those tax increases that they just did last year in last year's budget, it's not bringing in the revenues and stuff, because we have three budget busters, the MBTA.
That's the transit system.
Yes, and we have the Medicaid budget, and we have the big dig.
So there you go, the big public works project.
Yeah.
So you've got taxes up, and still the hole is there. What's going to happen, Bill?
Well, what's going to happen is the new governor, Governor Romney, is talking about raising fees and making more budget cuts. He's trying to avoid making cuts in human services, but like he just said the other day, that he may have to cut deeper into the human services budget and other programs. He's talking about 8,000, 10,000 layoff from state employees. So I'm one of them, but...
Ooh, so it could be you.
Yeah.
A lot of jobs and a lot of services on the line. Nicholas Jenny, is there a point at which this budget crunch across the country in so many states threatens some kind of basic social contract between citizens and what they expect from their state governments? Are we at that outer realm?
Oh, I don't think it's that bad yet. Mm-hmm. I think the sort of next one is when you're getting pretty widespread pain from people, and Bill, could be one of them. Let's hope not.
Well, on double front there as a state employee.
Right. Just because, if you start seeing people, states are downsizing their employment roles partially just by what they call attrition. As people leave jobs, they don't replace them, or as they retire, they don't hire new ones. If you're really laying people off who are in mid-career, that hurts. If you're increasing class sizes, that hurts, and a lot of people don't like that. If you're not maintaining the roads and they're starting to crumble, people don't like that. There's that sort of level where it becomes really noticeable what it is that the state is doing and what it's not doing, which ideally, you'd like it to work that, what the state is doing for people is it goes almost unnoticed, except when it comes election time, I guess.
And I want to come back to Amity Schley's perspective that the important thing here is to make a state hospitable for economic growth. That's really the way out. But can that work in a period when the whole national economy, big part of the world economy, is in a slump?
Well, it's never a good time to do this kind of thing. Certainly, it's a bad time now. But I actually looked comparing two economies, Maine and Ireland.
Maine and Ireland, that 51st state.
Because they were both poor and rocky and tourist places that were full of poverty. And when you look at their paths, which diverged from the 80s on, Maine was spend and tax, and Ireland cut the size of government from half the economy to a third of it. Ireland suddenly became this economic miracle. All of Europe wanted to go to Ireland, and Maine is still in trouble. So the point is relative competitiveness. Mm-hmm. Maine and Ireland really does matter. You want to keep that in mind.
Arturo Perez, how about that? When you look at 50 states, if they all dive in, cut taxes to make themselves more attractive for business and innovation, can everybody win?
Clearly, states often get into a situation where they want to try to draw economic development, and they use tax incentives in such a manner to draw in big manufacturing or other type of companies that can create jobs and obviously help boost the state economies. But if we go back to the problems that we're facing here, states have to figure out some way of solving their problems and these budget gaps. And I don't think if a state is facing a fairly sizable shortfall, it's basically you can't cut your way out of the problem. And that's where some of these things are coming out. We did see some $9 billion worth of new taxes instituted this year across the country to resolve some of the problems the states were facing. Again, it's a fraction of what states raised back in 1991 when they raised about $15.1 billion. It is a necessary action given that the states, again, as Nick mentioned earlier in the program, live under this balanced budget requirement, which is that they, unlike the federal government, they can't go into deficit spending situations.
They cannot end the year in the red.
No.
So it's an immediate challenge for them.
It is an immediate challenge, and that's why some of the taxes that Kansas and Nebraska instituted this year are temporary in nature, in the sense that they have sunset dates for which they will go back to their previous levels. They realize that there is a need for additional revenue, and they've instituted temporary tax increases on personal income and general sales.
Well, there's one way to go. Dave's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have 3 points. Mm-hmm. My first point is the national deficit is, what, $6 trillion plus?
That's big. I don't know
how the national government, how the government could bail each state out when we already have a $6 trillion deficit.
Well, okay. I suppose they could, but they surely are not going to.
Right. Okay, then I'm from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wisconsin gave money back when we had money in the coffers. And then what the old governor did was sold the tobacco settlement to be able to pay, to eliminate the debt from last year. So there we're really, you know, hurting. And then my third point is, how about let businesses pay their fair share of taxes? Everyone says, well, we got to make it hospitable for businesses to be able to do business in the state. What the states do is they compete against one another when they give all these tax breaks to businesses instead of making it just a standard tax for in any state. So what we do is we pit one state against the other, and then businesses don't even pay their fair share of taxes, and then we have companies like Stanley Tool who move out of the country and don't pay any taxes there at all.
Put their home in the Bahamas. But what is your, but can you imagine, Dave, that competition might actually make the entire country more competitive, or does it just drive it to the fiscal poorhouse?
Well, I think what it's driving us to the poorhouse, because you can't get nothing for nothing. You have to be able to support the communities that you live in. Now, if you're a good corporate citizen, you support your state that you're in. That's what charters are, state charters.
Dave, let me put that to Emily Schlaes. Emily, what about it? There's always this concern that if every state is cutting taxes to attract business, pretty soon you've got business around, but not enough tax base to support the expectations of the citizenry.
Well, a couple points here. I agree with our Milwaukee caller that it is wrong to differentiate between outsiders whom you want to lure and the local people. There's a word for that. That's called ring fencing, and it's bad economics in the long run. It's unfair.
You mean when you offer special incentive to lure a factory in?
One team, when the development mm-hmm. office of the state of Wisconsin makes a special dealie with, that's not right. Everyone in Wisconsin or Massachusetts should get the same deal, every business, as an outsider, and that's generally the goal. But the second point is, there is plenty of evidence that when you have overall lower rates, business is attracted to the venue and it grows. Texas has Dell Computer. Why does it have Dell Computer? Well, one reason is Texas has no income tax. It got something out of it, jobs, growth.
But if we all put our income taxes at zero, then where does that leave us?
But that's a theoretical. We're never going to be there. We're always talking about down and down. But there is a second point here, which we've touched on. We need to bring out more. There are structural problems that have nothing to do with taxes. Medicaid is one of them. If all of state budgets will be eaten up by Medicaid by 2020, that's a huge problem. We have to re-examine Medicaid. It's a defined benefit program. It's too expensive. We're all going to be hostage through our state governments to grandma.
We'll come back and look at those mandates. Amity, stand by. We're looking at state governments in crisis tonight. They're broken. They don't know how to fix it. Why do state governments swing between feast and famine? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about state governments in crisis. They're broke and they don't know how to fix it. Would you pay higher taxes to keep the roads paved and the Medicaid flowing? Are our expectations and our willingness to pay out of whack somehow? And how far would you go for new revenues? More casinos, more scratch tickets, sell the Capitol Dome, you name it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from the Rockefeller Institute of Government by Nicholas Jenny, from the National Conference of State Legislatures by Arturo Perez, and by our own On Point News analyst, Amity Schlaes. You can join us as well. Mark is on the line from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Evening.
My point is this. What we're experiencing now is the result of an economic fact of life that conservatives never learn, and that is that unregulated capitalism inevitably leads to economic chaos. We're seeing the result of deregulation that went on during the Reagan years, which led to the corporate corruption that we're seeing now that threw hundreds of thousands of people out of work. People lost their life savings. There's nobody left out there to pay taxes. And those corporations rotted from within because they were deregulated. They were gutted by the people that ran them. And they ultimately had enough power, being unregulated, to wind up not paying their fair share of taxes. And if you look around, that's exactly what's going on.
So,
there's no money left out there for states or even the federal government, which is back in deficit spending.
Mark, what do you make of Amity Schlaes' rendering of the Ireland story, where they cut way back on government spending, gave a lot more harness to business, and ended up the economic darling of Europe?
Well, let's talk about apples and oranges. I mean, you can't compare Ireland to Maine, I don't think. And you can't compare the economic system in Ireland to the economic system in the United States. I don't care how you slice
mm-hmm.
it. It's apples and oranges.
Mm-hmm. You're looking at corruption at home and saying it's just eating the guts out of this. Thanks for your call, Nicholas Jenny. How about it? Do you draw a connection between where we are now and what Mark calls unregulated capitalism?
I don't know if you can draw a direct connection between that and I mean the most obvious contributing factor to what happened here is that the economy went down, and I don't think there's too many people saying that all of the terrible things that did happen, of course, with your Enrons and global crossings and
they sure
like
didn't
that.
Help.
They didn't help, but they didn't cause it, and so it's the business cycle. It's you know, there's a world recession going on, there are, you know, your extraneous imponderable factors. You know, if we go to war and the price of oil goes up, things are just going to get worse, it's very difficult. I mean, certainly. From the point of view of a state official, there's not too much they can do about that.
Amity, you hear Mark's complaint. He sees unregulated capitalism as a bull in the china shop here, wrecking everything.
Well, it's a nice Oliver Stone movie, Wall Street 3, but you want to look at the big picture. Unemployment is still down relative to many other periods. Job creation is up relative to many other periods. Wages are up even after inflation. We've made some real gains in the economy since the 70s and 80s. I don't think a lot of people would want to go back to the 70s and 80s. I remember college in the 70s when people thought the best thing they could become was a bartender because skilled wages were not rewarded. It wasn't just fun to be a taxi driver. It was relatively the same wage. We've improved a lot in many ways. Now we know that if we learn a skill, we're rewarded for it. It's a much different culture. I don't think you can dismiss it all just because of the current downturn.
Mm-hmm. Arturo Perez, looking at this systematically here, we've seen these pendulum swings of feast and famine with the states before. Is there something endemic to state legislatures, state government, that makes them always run the spending up too high when times are good and therefore always hit a wall when things go south?
Well, it's just the peaks and valleys that Nicholas was talking about in terms of the economy. The most recent peak was unprecedented in the sense that it followed the longest economic expansion in this country's history. There was a period there where we kept expecting a downturn. It never came. Well, it finally came, but after the longest expansion period between the end of the last recession in 1991 and what we saw occur last year in 2001. And it threw a lot of people off. People kept on pushing back their estimates as to when that end would come.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, we got into a situation, of course, states found themselves again facing the unexpected, and it came, and it came in such a quick way, especially with the $7 to $8 trillion meltdown on Wall Street.
It was bad, but it always seems to come in. We were talking about it. We saw in the early 90s that you can just look back through history. Is there no way to keep it on a more even keel so that states don't have to go through the crunch, the pain of these radical reductions on a dime?
Building up your reserve funds, which states did across the board, across the country, balancing your tax structure so you don't rely too heavily on any one source of revenues, like just general sales tax or personal income, such that you have sort of a three-legged approach where mm-hmm. personal income taxes, general sales taxes, and all other taxes make up your tax structure so that you can be more insulated, having a diverse economy that you're not too dependent on technology, the technology sector or the service sector or manufacturing, that you have sort of a diverse economy that can help insulate you against some, or at least it won't protect you entirely, but it will at least soften some of the unexpected drops that come along in the economy from time to time.
It's the old balanced portfolio. Nice setup if you can get it. Steve's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd just like to share a phrase I heard a BBC commentator make. Mm-hmm. And the phrase is private wealth in the midst of public squalor. And I think that's an apt phrase, and I think we need to decide, is that the kind of society we want? I think, unfortunately, we've been the victim of a propaganda machine from the right that's always come out against taxes and attacked the Democrats or liberals as tax and spend, tax and spend. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry, that's how we got out of the Depression, was by tax and spend. And for the commentator that talked about Ireland, from what I understand, in Ireland, every Irish family is guaranteed a place to live, a home. So they had a strong social net before they cut the business taxes. We don't have that social net. And it's the poor and the working people that spend their money because they need to. Giving tax breaks to the rich makes no sense. They don't spend it. You can't buy. There's only so many houses you can buy.
Steve, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. Arturo Perez, how about it? Steve raises the phrase, private wealth, public squalor. Is that where the state's fiscal crisis is helping land this country?
No. I mean, we've got a situation here where we're talking about a drop that has occurred. This is not the sky is falling. This is a situation that states are facing head on. We had some $49 billion worth of budget balancing measures that states took on and succeeded in implementing this past year. There's additional, it's clear evidence that states are well into year two of a budget crisis, and they are resolving it as we move along. So, some of the doom and gloom discussion here, I think, overstates what states are facing.
But Arturo Perez, with due respect, I think you're missing the emotional edge of what our caller's putting on the table there. He's saying he's looking around, and here's a phrase that sums up what he sees. Is he living under an illusion, or are you maybe a little too mellow about the pain that some people are feeling?
No, absolutely. There is pain being felt out there. If you're one of the state employees that has been laid off in one of the state governments that is using a tax or a reduction in force to balance his budget, clearly the pain is there. And that's why I'm saying it. And I mean, I keep referring to the tough choices that lawmakers have to make. And there are sometimes not very pleasant decisions that need to be made in the interest of balancing a state budget. But those are the laws that we live under in terms of balanced budgets or that states cannot go into a deficit situation. I think it's in the best interest of the public that states don't go into deficit situations like the feds have done, and it is, I think, notable on the part of states that they will manage to get through this somehow, and at the same time, for those who obviously will find some pain in terms of either having their services cut, perhaps even losing employment, these are, you know, not things they want to hear, but at the same time, it is happening, and it's happened in the past.
Nicholas, Jenny, our time's running down, but how about this Medicaid issue? Amity Schley says it's going to leave everybody on the rocks if we don't get a hold of it. Do you agree? Do we have to change the formula somehow? States are responsible for a big whack of that, health care for the poor.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's a definitely difficult problem in that the states. It is an unfunded mandate, if you will, or a partially funded mandate, and it's becoming a very large part in overalls. It's about the second biggest thing that states spend money on after primary secondary education, It having a tendency to get larger too, so it is a problem. One of the things, of course, that states would like is they would like a little bit more help, perhaps from the federal government in these bad times on that.
Of course, everybody would like a little more health care all around the block. Nicholas Jenny, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Sure.
Nicholas Jenny is senior policy analyst with the Fiscal Studies Program at the Rockefeller Institute of Government. And Arturo Perez in Denver, Colorado, thank you for being with us.
Tom, thank you again.
Arturo Perez is analyst with the Fiscal Affairs Program at the National Conference on State Legislatures. Amity Schles, our time is short. Last word goes to you.
50 flowers bloom, 50 states doing experiments. We'll have some room for optimism, see how they handle it.
Well, they're going to have to have some great creativity out there, and we'll see what it looks like. Amity Schles, thanks so much for being with us tonight. Amity Schles is senior columnist with the Financial Times. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The state of Washington may be home to big businesses like Microsoft, but the Evergreen State is still facing a $2 billion budget shortfall. Kate Riley is a columnist for the Seattle Times, and in this radio diary, she confesses that everyday people, like her, may be partly responsible for Washington State's economic woe.
True confession time. I was once busted for tax evasion. Sales tax evasion, that is. Please let me explain. I was young and poor, and I needed a bed. So my fiancé and I drove 35 miles south across the state border into a tiny hamlet in Oregon where no one pays sales tax. We were lured by a furniture store flyer advertising a big sale on mattress sets and, okay, I admit it, the additional savings of about 8% in combined state and local sales tax. Add free delivery and the 90-day same-as-cash deal, and we couldn't resist. We paid off the bed with wedding gift cash and set about living happily ever after. More than a year later, a letter arrived. We had been busted by the revenuers. The letter sternly reminded me of my obligation to pay a use tax on out-of-state purchases. Chastened, I stuffed my guilt and a check for $42 into an envelope and sent it off to Olympia. Ignorance of the law is no defense, they say. But at the time, I honestly didn't know I was supposed to pay taxes on purchases made out-of-state. All purchases. Shoot, I still need to send 65 cents off for the $10 Hank Williams bobblehead I brought back from a recent Nashville trip. My inner penny pincher just thought it was a good deal. A lot of other people still think so, too. The Revenue Department's latest figures estimate this year Washington State will lose about $57 million on cross-border sales, $60 million on Internet purchases, and a whopping $140 million to catalog sales. That adds up to $257 million, or about 10% of the state budget deficit lawmakers have to fill. The state gets almost 52% of its revenues from the sales tax, a practice the Washington State Tax Structure Study Committee says is outdated partly because of the out-shopping phenomenon. Last month, the Tax Committee recommended some ways to update our system, including cutting the state sales tax and imposing an income tax, a hint of which attracted controversy before the report was even released. Easy answers are not to be found. Remember my little jaunt to Oregon, where people pay income tax, not sales tax? Oregon state finances are so bad that last week, the Oregon Business Council proposed the opposite of Washington's tax committee, slash Oregon's income tax and impose a sales tax, which voters there have rejected 9 times. I guess the grass is always greener on the other side of the border.
Kate Riley is a columnist with the Seattle Times. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Alina Mata, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're